Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $150 into something bigger when you bet on moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$150 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
If you have a podcast and want to monetize it stress-free, you need the Odyssey Creator Lab. We'll host your podcast for free, and our experienced sales team brings in the advertisers and the revenue. Easy. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com and let us show you the money.
Good evening, and welcome to Amplify, a program that reflects on life from both a spiritual and a secular perspective. I'm Father Ron Langwin, hoping you have felt the warmth of God's love in your life this day, but especially the joy you feel when you share that love with others. As we do each week, I'd like to begin our program with a story that is based on faith and formed with imagination. It was created by a friend who wrote it after being inspired by sacred scripture. And my hope is that it will enable you to open both your heart and your mind to our topic this evening. Our guest writes in a book, and I'll explain it all a little bit later, but the book is called Mortal Adhesions, A Surgeon Battles the Seven Deadly Sins to Find Faith, Happiness, and Inner Peace. It's only the part of our program and perhaps not even the main part. But he writes, throughout my life, I have searched for peace and happiness, conditions that are inextricably and intimately related. Inner peace refers to the state of psychological calmness in the presence of stress, and it is doubtful it can always be achieved. But as a goal, it is definitely worthwhile. My story begins with my parents, who planted and nurtured the seeds of my existence, and whose beliefs, habits, and quirks, for better or worse, for a time, became my own. My father, mother, and then my wife were the dominating influences in my life, and I have attempted to portray them candidly. Finally, against all that my extensive education has taught me about logic, the scientific method, and rational thinking, I believe that the universe is ultimately concerned with our existence. Once I rejected the belief that I am in command of my own life, the universe responded with events that can only be called miraculous, the source of which is a loving God. As you become aware of the ascending happiness levels in your life, I believe you will also experience them. Look for the mysteries where the divine becomes visible. And I'd also like now, as we do each week, to tell a story that is based on faith and formed with imagination. Mary Magdalene stood near the tomb where the Master had lain long ago. The large stone still stood in the same spot it was placed when it was rolled back. It seemed as if time had stood still. She remembered how she had told Jesus, "Master, I love you. Your words are truly gifts of great beauty and power." Jesus had nodded, and with sadness in his eyes said, "They are my Father's, not mine. I only speak them." "Yes, Master," she responded, "but you are special because you were chosen to speak them." He looked at her and said, "Woman, we are all special. You as well as I have a special place in my Father's heart and home." Mary Magdalene thought for a while and then said, "Master, I wish I had an image, a likeness of you on cloth." Jesus was strangely silent. It seemed like time stood still. Then he said to his friend, "Woman, I shall give the world such a gift. It will be hidden for a long time, and when it is found, it will strengthen those who have forgotten my words, my love and all that I have done. It shall lay upon the earth, be picked up and held with great love. It shall be hidden for a while, but in time they will realize who I was, what I looked like, and how my life came to an end. She said, Master, I've never heard you speak like this before. Each word seems to be an effort. Jesus responded, Woman, woman, again, I tell you that you are special, as are all people. My Father did not place me upon the earth so that I would be forgotten. He has given me his words. He has given me seeds of hope and love to instill in others. Men and women who come after me will do likewise. But you are special. I tell you again. Mary Magdalene stood staring at the empty tomb, remembering these words and how they had taken the cloth in which Jesus had been wrapped for burial. Although it had touched his torn and broken body, it was a gift that gave them hope. It was a way of keeping him with them. He wondered if his spirit was as broken as his body. Then she looked up at the sky and said, I shall never forget you. She knew he was more than special. He was the Son of God. And our guest this evening, who wrote the first part that I said, is Dr. John Sotosani. He performed oral surgery in San Diego, California, was an associate professor in the Department of Periodontics at the University of Southern California. He is the author of many articles in peer-reviewed scientific journals and invented products and techniques for bone growth, which he taught worldwide. He is a former president of the California Society of Periodontists and the San Diego chapter of Legatus, an international organization of business leaders united in Christ. Dr. Sotosani, welcome to Amplify.
Thank you, Father Ron. What a beautiful reading you did. Thank you.
Thank you. The first one was a good one too. There's much more. We'll talk about. We will get to that eventually. And okay. and just some background so people understand. Person who represented you called me and said that you had some thoughts on and some opinions, some background, and thought you'd found something new about that you wanted to reveal about the Shroud of Turin. My ears perked up right away because I've had devotion to the Shroud for a long time. It's not active, but it's always there. And there are many connections that it makes in various guests that I have on my program who aren't talking about it directly. And he said, well, he had written a previous book titled Mortal Adhesions. And I said, well, for the sake of some background, I'd like a copy of it. And so they sent me the book, and I loved the book because it really ties his life into what attracted him to the Shroud and really brought about a sense in his life. And Doctor, you had a significant transformation in your life, and you came to realize how persistent our Creator is in wanting us to know who he is. So tell us a little bit about your earlier life when you had just about everything there was to have before your spiritual transformation. You knew so many famous people in the world. You had just about anything you wanted for a while.
Thank you. I will. Let's talk about it. My dad was born in Italy, and I think that impacted me in many ways because he felt discriminated against, and he kept telling his two children, study hard. You have to earn respect. You have to make a lot of money. You have to have titles. And so I went through my youth thinking that. And so eventually I accomplished what he asked me to do. I went to the University of Pennsylvania. Then I went to Georgetown University and got my doctorate degree. Was in the military for a few years and then specialized at the University of Southern California and the VA Hospital of Los Angeles. But hearing Dad's words, be successful, et cetera, I just didn't want to stop at seeing patients, although I did that almost full time. Additionally to that, I taught part-time at the university. I wrote papers. I made contacts. And eventually built the practice up to 40 employees by the time I was 40. And their stresses that began to come upon me became very heavy. Even though, as you said, Father Ron, that I had what everybody would think would be the perfect life. If you look from far away, you would say, well, he's married. Right. He's a wonderful woman. He's got children. He's got all these things. And then movie stars as patients, Nobel Prize winners, paid for trips by the University of Southern California worldwide. What could be better? But as you asked, what happened? Well, life doesn't go on like that forever. And as I built this practice, a number of things happened. For instance, I had four or five, six doctors working underneath of me. Several of them had affairs. These doctors were married and had affairs with staff. I had an employee who embezzled an awful lot of money. I paid a contractor up front for half of a big build out. And then when we completed the new building, I paid him the rest. Found out he didn't pay his subcontractors, even though I paid him in full. So I got lien leases, lien notices from the city saying I had to close up the doors. Mm-hmm. And these things just went on and on until I was beginning to feel tremendous pressure and stress.
And you describe the various phases of your life as reflections of the seven deadly sins: pride, greed, lust, envy, gluttony, wrath, and sloth. And you thought at each point that it was the way you wanted life to be. Fame right. and finance, as you discussed, just explain, were among them, including an understanding and loving wife. But those were phases that you came to understand as mysteries where the divine was becoming visible to you, although you didn't understand it at time. And there was a point when prayer seemed irrational and unscientific, even as you practiced your Catholic faith, but you thought that it might be your only hope. And at one point, you had a sense of trepidation for the future. There was times when you had no time, you explain, for religion. And so you pondered about the concepts of luck and mental toughness and optimism. But and you said, and you thought at one point, that who needs heaven when there is heaven on earth? And then a change began to happen. Tell us about that change.
Well, you're right. I actually began to think that in some ways I was my own God, like who needed God? I think I would call myself an agnostic during that time when I was accumulating the seven deadly sins as you describe them. And along with the problems that I just talked about with the practice in the office and employees and contractors, I began to feel a lot of stress. I had normally been athletic. All of a sudden, I couldn't play tennis or golf. I had neck pain, back pain. I wasn't sleeping. And you almost sometimes, when you're living, quote, the perfect life, something has to happen. And it did to me. I can remember the night that I was sitting in my car with the rooftop open, and I looked up at the stars. And I didn't know if God actually existed. And I said, God, if you are up there, please help me. All I want is inner peace.
Right.
And the very next day, things began to slowly happen. God knew that I wasn't ready to just automatically start becoming a perfect Catholic. And one of the things that I really learned, and you mentioned the word, and it's a key word, is love. And then I learned that love and fear were two opposites. Let me give you a little example. I'd be driving my car and somebody would pull out of a gas station right in front of me, so I had to put on my brakes. I would get so upset. I would blow the horn and take it home with me, and it was small little things. But even big things would happen. And sometimes in my office, I got along very well with my patients, but I'll never forget. We'll use the name Mr. Smith. My assistant came in. It was about, I had an appointment with him at 10 at 8 o'clock, but I had something to do beforehand. I was 10 after 8. She said, Mr. Smith is really upset with you, and he's going to leave. So I finished doing what I was doing, and it was about 15 minutes afterwards, and I remembered what I had learned about love and fear. And what it taught me was that anybody that's not operating from love is feeling fear. So he's angry and upset. So what's he fearful about? I went through my mind. Is he afraid I'm going to hurt him because it's a surgical practice? Is he afraid it's going to cost a lot of money, not covered by insurance? And I walked down the hall to his room thinking about his fear. And I didn't, normally, a couple of weeks earlier, I probably would have gone in there and said, well, look, if you want to leave, leave. But this time I went in and I said, Mr. Smith, I'm so sorry to keep you waiting. And in fact, there's no charge for today. If you look, he said he had to leave because he had a business appointment. So I said, if you let me do it, I'll do an examination at no charge. So he did it, and he didn't have to leave after all. And he turned out to be one of my best patients. So that's just a little example of what I learned after I cried out to God. Many more things had to happen, though.
And you lived. You had lived the seven deadly sins, you explain, and the things that you reflected while this is going on. While most people believe in heaven, they ignore the possibility of hell. Although, right. If Christianity is true, their destiny might be to end up there in the event of an unseen tragedy. And so even while you're going through living these seven key sins, you're still thinking, your mind's working, your faith has not died. It still is alive. You end up saying that writing faith is a gift. Sometimes it's hard earned, and sometimes we fall into it. But if we have it, we must treasure, protect, and work to maintain it, if not increase it. For having it once is no guaranteed. We'll take it to the grave, which is when it counts.
Isn't that true?
Yes. And you lived it. You live so many things. But then as we begin to move towards what we were going to really talk about, what we wanted to talk at the beginning is the shroud, you visit the chapel of the Holy Shroud. And what begins to happen in your life, having lived the seven deadly sins?
I was just beginning to build my faith when my wife, who was very religious, I think she had maybe one of the national Catholic newspapers came by the house. And I wasn't thinking about reading it, but it was the only thing available at the moment. And I saw that the Shroud of Turin, which I had heard about, was going to be exposed for only the third time in 100 years or something like that. It was the year 2000, so it was Jubilee year. And at the very time that was going on, I had another brochure right on my desk that said there was a surgical meeting in Switzerland. And I wanted to actually go to that. And then I thought, well, I'll maybe go to both since I'm going to be there. What attracted me about the Shroud of Turin is that it had scientific background or findings. There had been a team in the 1970s that went there and really did explore and do experimentation. And so I needed science. I needed facts at this point. I wasn't ready for pure faith. Eventually that came. But at this point in time, so I got to go see the Holy Shroud, and I was blessed. I use that word because I really feel God was guiding me along this path. And it was a long path, my conversion. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I even tell you, Father, well, you've read the book. So it took almost 40 years for full conversion in my life. But when I got to the Church of the Holy Shroud, there were massive crowds. And I got in line, I had a ticket, and the man in charge said, "You will have 4 minutes in front of the shroud." And I thought, oh, I flew across the ocean, I've been waiting for right. hours, and I get 4 minutes. So I go by the shroud on my right, it's all being timed, and I had to turn left to go out the center aisle. And just as I did that, a man in a seat right there got up. And I thought, well, I'll sit down until they ask me to leave. So I sat down, and no one ever asked me to leave.
Yes.
So I spent as long as I could until my train ticket said I had to leave. But I just looked at the shroud, and what hit me was the wounds. As a surgeon, I looked at all the wounds, and then I looked at the blood streaming from the wounds, and I actually got teary-eyed. And it actually set me up for some things that would happen right. later in life.
And so you were at one of the lowest points in your life, and you feel the wonder and mystery of it. And had God brought you there, and you talk about, "I was deeply sorry for my sins and wanted to change. It was an epiphany of sorts, a rarity for me." While most people believe in heaven, they ignore the possibility of hell. Although, if Christianity is true, their destiny might be to end up there in the event of an unforeseen tragedy. You wonder, had God brought me here to contemplate his face on a statue days after scrutinizing the same face on a cloth in Italy?
So yeah, you're talking about my trip to Brazil.
Yes.
Which I did right immediately afterwards.
Okay, we're going to be taking a break, and when we come back, we're going to begin to talk directly about the shroud. Welcome back to Amplify, where our guest is Dr. John Sottosanctì. The first half hour of our program was sort of a preparation to talk about the shroud of Turin. Doctor, tell us what... I should say your name means under saints. Does that have any significance to you?
I have almost, now that I look back, think that, you know, I think some of the saints, certainly my mother prayed for me, just like St. Monica okay. prayed for her son. And people translate it under the saints.
What is the Shroud of Turin? There's no question that there are people who are listening to this program don't know what it is.
Well, why don't I just describe it physically? It's a cloth made out of linen, expensive linen. It's about 14 and a half feet long by about 3.5 feet wide. And many people believe that Jesus Christ was buried in that cloth. We know from the scriptures that Joseph of Arimathea provided the burial cloth for Christ. He was a wealthy man. He could have afforded something that was that costly. And there are many legends that talk about a cloth with a face on it that have been around for many, many years. But it did not show up where we have documentation regularly until the year roughly 1355. And that was in the hands of one of the Knights Templar, because legends say that the shroud had gotten to Constantinople. It was a cloth with an image of Christ on it. And when when in 1204, Constantinople was basically sacked by the Crusaders, and they took all the relics. And so the cloth with the face of Christ on it disappeared, but it showed up again in 1350s. And the knight basically had it displayed in the church, and it stayed in his family for at least 100 years until it was sold to the Savoy family, who then took it. Well, first they took it to Chambéry, France in 1532, which that's very important because there was a major fire in the church of Chambéry, France. They had folded this cloth with a image of Christ, but you could barely make him out. But they knew it was valuable. They was believed it was the burial cloth of Christ. The Knight Templar said it was. So they put it in a silver box, and the silver melted, and the cloth was folded. So silver dropped down and burned holes in one corner of the folded cloth. But when you open it up, you have many triangular holes, which have been patched. They were patched in 1534 by the Poor Clare nuns. So we have record of that cloth being in the Savoy family, first in Chambéry, France, and eventually making its way to Turin and being in the hands of the Savoy family. So that's basically what the cloth is. It's a linen cloth with a faint image of Christ. But things changed dramatically in the year 1898. A amateur photographer by the name of Secunda Pia, who was actually a lawyer by trade, was commissioned to take a photograph of the shroud because they were bringing it out. Some people say it's the 400th anniversary of that particular church. Some people say it was the wedding of one of the Savoy ladies. But for whatever reason, he took a picture of the cloth with the faint image of a man who people said was Christ, but you couldn't see much. But when he took the negative plates into the darkroom, a lot of our listeners, the older ones are going to say, oh, negative, sure, we understand it. The younger ones are going to think digital, you know, digital photography. Well, this is the old days when you had negative, you didn't even have negative film yet, you had negative plates. And he looked at the negative plates after developing them, and he was looking at a negative image. So the whites and the blacks were reversed. And what he saw was a dramatic face of a crucified man, well, face and body, but you looking at the face, you could see the cheek was swollen from blows, and the nose, the cartilage in the nose was broken, and there was bleeding coming down the forehead from a crown of thorns. And that really began the scientific interest in this cloth.
Right. And we're going to talk about something new that you have found as we build some understanding about the shroud. It's important to note that John in his gospel testifies to the importance, and he was one of the first into the tomb. Where there were, John's gospel tells us there were two separate cloths found in the tomb, linen burial cloths and a face cloth rolled up in a place all by itself. And we should point out that not too long ago, St. John Paul II referred to it as a mirror of the gospel. And it seems to be fully unable to be reproduced, doesn't it?
Oh, definitely. You know, there's a major controversy we might as well talk about right from the beginning. I mean, the first thing that happened, 1898, but then not much happened with the cloth. They thought Secunda Pia actually had made this all up. But in 1931, a photographer, professional by the name of Henri, took other photographs and verified everything. And so they ended up putting a team together of scientists in the 1970s called the STIRP team. And those guys basically verified that it wasn't painted, it wasn't created by heat or anything. And they basically said, we don't know how it was made. And so that was in 1978. But 10 years later, there was carbon dating testing done. Now, the scientific team called the STIRP team said that we think there should be carbon dating, but what we should do is get 7 laboratories and 7 different samples from around the shroud, and then we'll really be able to tell if this dates back 2,000 years. But the carbon dating people ended up taking one little tiny piece by the corner, right where they did a lot of patching in the 16th century, and carbon dated that to the years 1260 to 1390. So now we have half of the people, I don't know if it's half or not, but half saying, oh, it's a forgery, it's a medieval forgery. And we have the other half saying, oh, no, they could never be reproduced. In fact, I now do a monthly radio show on the Shroud of Turin, and my last one that I did was the 9 indisputable facts of the Shroud of Turin, attesting to its really being the burial cloth of Christ. And so this battle has been going on now between the both sides. And so, yeah, I probably, if we're going to be taking a break, I probably shouldn't start talking about my findings of came out.
No, we still have 14 minutes.
Oh, okay. So we can keep going. Great. So anyway, I got interested. Remember, I saw the Shroud in the year 2000. And so I'm still doing surgery every day, pretty much, and writing papers. And I'm politically active in the various organizations. And so I didn't have a lot of time to study the Shroud. So whenever articles came across on the computer or whatever, and I learned about a site called shroud.com, which carries all the articles, and I would read. So I've done intermittent study over that period of time. A little over a year ago, I was asked to be one of four main speakers for a Turin event where the very parishes, any parish that wanted it in San Diego County could have a 4-day exhibit of the Shroud of Turin with all kinds of reproductions of the crown of thorns and the nails, the scourging whip, and a life-size statue of Christ that was made from the three-dimensional information encoded in the image on the Shroud. So that's where I became much more active in learning and studying. And then we had an international Shroud meeting, and these don't come every day, and sometimes they're in Europe. So I heard there was going to be one in St. Louis this year in 2025. It was in July. And so I went and I became well acquainted with people whose papers I had read. They were scientists and they were great believers of the Shroud, and got to know quite a few of them. And I said, well, you know, my area of expertise was the oral region. So I tend to spend a lot of time looking at that region. And, you know, people have mentioned that they think they see fingers or bones in the image on the Shroud. But those who want to deny it, there's this large group of people that want to deny the Shroud. Now, why would you say that? Because if you say that is the Shroud of Turin and it is the burial cloth of Jesus Christ, Jesus Christ not only lived, was crucified, and then he definitely resurrected, then you've got to say everything that Christ told you and the way you should live your life is what you should do. And these people don't want to change their lives. Oh, yeah. They want to keep doing everything they're doing. And they are vehemently opposed to anything that says the Shroud is, that the Shroud is real. But all the studies that have come out, I'd say there's over 2,000 studies. There are 102 disciplines, scientific disciplines, that have studied the Shroud of Turin. And if you don't believe that, go to shroud.com and spend a bunch of time on it. Mm-hmm. And I'd say 90% of them say it's actually the burial cloth of Christ. There's absolutely no doubt about it. A man, he's a producer, David Rolfe, I believe his name is, about 3 years ago, he was an atheist, and then he learned about the Shroud, and he became very devout Catholic. And he said, I will give $1 million to anyone that can reproduce the image on the Shroud of Turin. In other words, this state of it being 1260 to 1390 based on the carbon dating testing. And again, I'm one of the ones that believe they tested a patch. If that were to be true, you would think that with today's technology, they could go out there and easily reproduce that image on the Shroud. But that image has, like I said, has it 9 or 10 indisputable facts. I could go on and on, but that would probably take another hour. So I don't think we'll head in that direction. So I decided to to get more involved studying the shroud. And I talked to one of the leaders, a guy by the name of Joe Marino. He's been active in shroud research for 40 years. And I struck up a friendship with him, and he said, yeah, why don't you get yourself a high-resolution photograph of the Shroud of Turin? You can get that online at a certain website and download it for free, and then take a really, real good look at it. So I did that. And this was about 2 months ago. And I looked at it. It didn't take me very long because I'm so used to looking at the anatomy of the oral cavity. And I could see almost, not the entire teeth, but I could see lower anterior teeth, a row of them. And something that was unique, because previous people have said, oh, they think they see teeth. But the shroud skeptics, of which there's this large contingent, as I kind of alluded to, would say, oh, no, that's just the threads of the shroud, the herringbone weave of the linen going up and down, making you think you see teeth. So my paper, and all you have to, if there's something, there's a site called academic.edu, and if you go on that site and just plug in last name Sotosanti and then shroud, my paper will come up, and they may ask you for your email address, but it's free. And you download the paper and you look at all the pictures. I saw something which I call it, well, it's known as the incisal plane. It's an imaginary plane connecting the biting surfaces of all the anterior teeth. The occlusal plane would be all the teeth, including the molars. It'd be like a big horseshoe. But I see this incisal plane very distinct and very realistic, and it goes horizontally left to right, totally 90 degrees against the vertical striations of the shroud. So I have a friend who ended up sending out a press release, and I wrote an opinion article, and he sent it out to various places. I think he sent it out first or second to The Blaze and they have the media organization. So they published it. If you were interested, look up Sotosanti, The Blaze, and you'll be able to read that article. And then some of the other fairly major news organizations picked up on it. Newsmax is they're growing by leaps and bounds. They're on the tails of CNN and Fox, did a major story on it. And then they had me just 2 weeks ago, they had me on two television programs, so they're news of the day type of things. And then I'd say I've seen at least 8 to 12 articles that have come out, even as far as London, England, about that discovery of the teeth on the shroud. And I've already been contacted by this skeptic group that wants to engage, you know, in a debate and prove me wrong. And so I've gotten very, you know, for somebody who really wasn't a believer till that long ago, I've gotten very, very involved in defending the Shroud of Turin.
It seems so. Like it's not an accident that it still exists. Why can something hidden people would think for centuries be that important? And how does it raise profound questions about life, death, and resurrection?
That's why there is so much intensity in the feelings, both pro and con, because if it truly is the burial cloth of Christ, number one, that in itself is something to venerate. Can you imagine that, to actually be able to come up and see the cloth and see all his suffering and his wounds and his blood? And that's what I noticed when I was in Turin 20 years ago, is the blood all over the shroud. That would be amazing in itself. But the only thing that explains the image, the only thing that we can come up with today, with all the technology we have, is the use of a laser. But that laser beam, you have to have 34,000 trillion watts of energy delivered to not create heat and burn the shroud. You have to do it in much less than a billionth of a second. There's no way in the world that anybody could have recreated the Shroud or created the Shroud in the 1260 to 1390. So it's quite evident that it is the burial cloth of Christ. And the only rational way that image appeared on there, exactly how it is, with all the properties that it has, was by this amazing explosion of light and energy, which we think is the resurrection. And so when John saw the burial cloth lying there, as you so nicely described, and then he saw and he believed. Mm-hmm. And we don't know if he saw the image of Christ on it, but something made him believe, because he could have said, oh, they stolen his body, but they didn't. He saw and believed. So he either saw the face of Christ on that shroud, or as some people think, the burial cloth is this 14-foot cloth. So they wrap Christ's body in it almost like a pita. So 4 7-feet of it are on his front side, and then it wraps around his head. 7 feet go down the back side. And then they tied him in it with this strip of linen around the waist. So some people think that he basically, with this burst of radiation or whatever it was, light energy, he disappeared and became resurrected, and the shroud just crumpled down, either on the floor or on the stone. And so he saw the burial cloth lying there with the still tied up, but the body gone. And so we don't know, but it's very exciting. I'm so happy to be part of it.
Can you tell us more about who God is? It might it exist because our Creator wants us to know who he is?
I do believe that. I believe that we're reaching a point where, you know, I don't want to be any kind of person saying that we're getting close to the second coming or whatever, but things are kind of crazy out there in the world right now, as I think you know. And I think for true believers, he's given us a gift. And that gift is, if you study it, you're going to find out how definite that gift is. I wish we did have that time to go over the 9 indisputable facts, but nobody can reproduce it. It is a gift, and it carries with it so much meaning, because if that truly is the burial cloth of Christ, and the image was formed by the resurrection, everything Christ said about what our behavior should be, we should be doing it right now. Because like you said earlier, Father Ron, we don't know when we're going to die. So it isn't like we can say, oh, we'll change it. We'll get a postal letter, or now you get an email, and it'll say, okay, your death is coming tomorrow. So you go ahead and go to confession, change your life like that. You can't do that. You got to start changing it now.
And so it's your skills, which include the eye of a surgeon trained in facial anatomy, has enabled you to see it in a way that it hasn't been seen before completely.
Different.
We can expect that's probably going to continue to happen as we continue to develop the skills that God gives to us.
I think so.
Okay, we just have 30 seconds, so I don't want to ask it in anything, but when we come back, give us just briefly the talk about those nine facts. Okay.
Well, I mentioned one of them already. It's a photo negative. We didn't understand photography to 1830. And so how in 1260 to 1390 could they create a forgery that had a photo negative property in it?
Okay, so we're coming up to our next break. We come back, we'll continue our discussion.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up, you get early payout on parlays too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
You've built a great podcast. The content's solid. The audience is growing. But the money, still not where it should be. That's where the Odyssey Creator Lab comes in. we host your podcast for free so you can keep doing your thing while our experienced sales team does their thing, finding advertisers and bringing in revenue. No fees, no stress, just real monetization. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com and let us show you the money.
About the Shroud of Turin. Welcome back to Amplify. If you're just tuning in, our guest is Dr. John Sottomusanti, who has developed a great love for the Shroud of Turin. He is a surgeon trained in facial anatomy, well known all over the world. People have come to see him, or he's gone to see them. The Shroud of Turin is the image of face of the crucified Christ, and it's existed before the Gospels were written. John in his Gospel testifies to its importance. He was said to be one of the first to enter the tomb to discover two separate cloths found in the tomb, linen burial cloths and a face cloth rolled up in a place by itself. Doctor, tell us a little bit about the 9 significant facts, the eight that we haven't touched upon.
Right. We've covered the photonegativity, in which you take a picture of the cloth, which is basically a light tan straw color, and then it comes out in the negative as black, but you see the white areas showing the face of Christ. I would recommend the listeners, maybe tomorrow, go ahead and Google the image of the Shroud of Turin, and you will see both images. You'll see the regular one of what the cloth looks like, and you'll see the negative image, which is a dramatic picture of Christ. So that in itself is there is no way in the world that in 1260 to 1390, which is when the carbon dating says the shroud was made, there's no way in the world that some forger could have ever figured out how to do that. The other thing that I noticed as a surgeon when I was actually there, I'll call this number 2, is that overall, the image is anatomically perfect. The body self is perfectly done. Of course, it's been battered and bruised, and when you look at it, you'll see all these wounds and all the blood on it too. But it would be very difficult to for somebody at that time on a fabric to paint that. They found out in the early 1970s that there were some unusual properties on that having to do with 3D information embedded. A instrument called the VP8 analyzer was developed. Some people say that it was developed for the space program because we were planning on sending modules out to the moon and the planets. And when we take photos of them, we see darks and lights, but we don't know where the valleys and the mountains are. So this analyzer, you can take a picture of the moon or a planet and put it in there, and you can see a 3-dimensional picture come out of it. So 2 scientists, Eric Jumper and John Jackson, were using the instrument, and they got the idea to put a Shroud of Turin picture in it. And they could not believe their eyes when they saw the face of Christ in 3 dimension, in a sense, come out of it. And then they put pictures of their children in it. And from what I have heard, it was all scrambled. You could barely even recognize them. So the Shroud of Turin is a very unique cloth and image. Just have found out, they figured out it's a series of light and darks, and it understands spatial distances, but nobody in the 12th, 13th century had that ability. We know that because we can look at the artwork that was done then.
Yeah, you describe it as a scientific mystery, a paradox.
Yeah, no, it absolutely is. So then you look at the image itself. And the scientists, they spent, the STURP team in the 1978, they spent 120 straight hours. They were given permission. Now, no one else has had any time with the Shroud since that. So, but we have tremendous amount of information. They brought with them cases, giant cases of all types of equipment. And they went in shifts and pairs, and they were a diverse group. There were some Catholics, some Protestant, there were atheists, Jews. There was everything there. In fact, it turns out that some of the people most supportive of the 2,000-year-old history of the Shroud were Jewish. Barry Schwartz and Dr. Adler is his last name, who did work on the blood. So the VP8 analyzer showing the 3D information is pretty dramatic. Now, while they were doing this study, they divided the shroud up into squares, and they numbered them. And one of the men on the team was a man by the name of Max Frei, F-R-E-I. He was a forensic pathologist from Switzerland, and he is the one that developed sticky tape sampling. It's even used today. It's where you go into a crime scene and you want to know if there's any dust or dirt or anything like that that's left behind by the perpetrator. So you take the sticky tape and push it on you all you on the room or the cloth or whatever is there. Well, they did that to the Shroud of Turin. And so what they did was they paired them together. They said this sticky tape came from this area, and they can tell exactly where it was. And they found a particular mineral, which is relatively rare. It tends to only be found in areas of caves or pools of water coming up out of the ground. And the name of the mineral is travertine aragonite. And they actually found, using the microscope, travertine aragonite on the nose, the knee, and the foot. And that goes right in hand with the Gospels of Jesus carrying the cross and falling three times. And so not only was it on his feet because he's traversing Via della Rosa and picking that up there, but he falls and it's on his knee, but it's also on his nose. So his face actually hit the ground. Again, how in the world would anyone in the 1300s or 1260 to 1390 ever have the ability to know that or have that? And that's definitely scientific evidence, proven, documented. The next thing that I have in my list is the crown of thorns. Crown of thorns was not the way we tend to see it in art. In art, it tends to be a ringlet or like a wreath around the head. But we know from the wounds, we can actually tell the plant that was used to make the crown of thorns. It was called Ziziphus spina Christi. And it has inch-long thorns. And those thorns would dig right into the head. So probably what happened, the Romans took their sword, cut off a piece of the rose bush with the thorns, did what they could to shape it into some sort of cap, tied it off with some string so it would stay on, and pushed it onto the head. And those thorns dug right through the scalp, right down to the skull. And that's why when you see the image of Christ's face in the photo negative, you see the blood in and around the top of the head, and you see it dripping onto the forehead. But also, when you look at the back wounds on the shroud, you see blood throughout the top of the head and on the back of the head. So if the forger in 1260 was trying to forge this thing, he would look at the art that was used in the day and imitate that. And it would have no idea of what plant was used and how it was used. So that's another strong indication. One of the things that really interested me is that when the STIRP team was there studying it, they were able to look at the underside of the shroud. There's a covering there that was put on after the fire. So up until this team in the 1970s looked at it, nobody really knew how far the image went in. And what they found was that the image itself was only several microns. Now, to put it in perspective, how thick is a micron? A human hair averages 50 to 100 microns. So if you're talking to 2 microns, you're talking about a fraction, 150th to 100th of a human hair. Any kind of paint, or dust or any minerals or any coloring agent, anything at all, would seep right through down in there. And they were actually able to take the fibers and look at them, cut them and look at them on the microscope. So a linen cloth, you have threads that form the herringbone weave. And then each thread is made up of several hundred microfibrils. And the thickness of the image is only several fibrils into the 200. It's just the very, very surface. So it's quite a mystery. And what they found is the area that is color changed, so that's why you see the image, it's dehydrated cellulose. It's aged cellulose. And the only thing that we can figure out today with modern technology is just the laser. And I've already mentioned experimentation with how much energy that we would need. It's virtually impossible. But the thinness of that is of the image is amazing.
Let me hold that one just for a second.
Yes.
My point is that if people are, what came to my mind is if people were thinking this just sounds too fantastic, they should have heard how the man who started the fires in California was caught.
Right.
Unbelievable in terms of the position of the sun and all kinds of other things. They were able to find this man. I don't want to get distracted, but I was amazed. So I'm being amazed again. Continue, please.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And the other thing is that the image, wherever the blood appeared, and there's blood all over the shroud. Remember, Christ was... he died from the crucifixion, and after he was dead, they were breaking the legs of all the ones that they thought still might be alive. But in fulfillment of Scripture, none of his bones were broken, but a Roman came over with a spear and put it into his side and created a 2 or 3 inch hole in his side. And that blood just poured out, and that's all on the shroud. But during this examination, when they looked at the blood stains, wherever the blood exists, the blood seeps all the way through the shroud, which makes sense. It's cloth. It's thin cloth, and it would seep through. But they're able to microscopically look at it, and wherever the blood is, there's no image. So for sure, the blood came first, which makes so much sense. Christ is crucified, right? They take him down from the cross. All the blood, he's dead, but the blood is on the body. Then they wrap him in the shroud, and they put him in this humid cave, and the blood stains seep onto the cloth. So the cloth, the blood is transferred, and there's no image. And then we believe Easter morning, when he resurrected, is when the image formed. And that's what we see scientifically. Mm-hmm. It's just incredible.
And let me just break in again to amplify my previous thoughts. I think what I'm trying to say is small details can be so significant. So these things you're describing, but go ahead.
I agree with you totally. That's why I think that, and I'm prejudiced about this, I think that this finding of the teeth and the incisal plane on the shroud is significant. We'll see. It's yet to be played out. So new. Okay. The next thing that's so interesting is the pollen grains. You know, pollen is everywhere. It's in the air right now. We all have pollen probably on our bodies. And so when they did the sticky tape testing, they picked up quite a bit of pollen. So that was the arena of Max Frei, the Swiss criminologist. So he took after they left, he took a sticky tape with him, and he had information where it all came from. And he was able to identify a number of pollen samples or different types of pollen. But he found that the most common pollen on the Shroud of Turin, remember, this is microscopic, long before the microscope was invented, the most common pollen was a plant called Gundelia turniforte. And there was something like 30% of the pollen on the entire shroud came from that plant. And that plant grows in Jerusalem, and it blooms in March, April, and May is the only time it blooms. And we know the crucifixion was the first week in April that year. So it just, and then if we have time, I'll go into the history of the shroud. But the shroud has a history long before 1350. There's shroud, we think it was in, we know it was in Constantinople, but again, the shroud deniers say, no, that's not true. But it was in Constantinople, so we see the pollens from there. And then we also see pollens from France and Western Europe, because obviously it's been there, and Italy now. So the pollen grains are a big part of the of the story.
So what can what can we expect modern technology might reveal even further?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think it's all going to have to do with how that image was formed. The man who did the research did it in Italy at one of their major scientific institutes, and he spent 5 years of his life doing it, and then published it in a major journal. So, but that would be it. And then the other thing is it ever going to be carbon dated again? You might ask. I mean, that's a question people ask all the time. Well, it's owned by the Pope. So up until recently, it was Pope Francis. So if Pope Leo decides he's going to allow it to be done again, he will allow it. But you have to know, if you look up carbon dating, it will say carbon dating is only accurate if you're doing it on a material that has not been contaminated. This shroud has been in two major fires, one in which it was in this chest in which it was so hot, silver melted down on it. We don't know whether that added carbon fibers, carbon particles to the cloth. And so what the church says, your faith should not rely on this. I think they probably say the same thing about a lot of the apparitions. They're there, you can believe them, but it's not the final answer of your faith. So I'm not sure the Vatican's going to want to have it tested again, although there's a large group of people that do want it tested.
And the man who died was in an upright position of crucifixion, and it's believed that the person would have been buried according to Jewish burial custom also.
Absolutely. In fact, yes. There's a little bit of a controversy going on. Some people think he would have been washed per Jewish custom. But if you really go back, and I actually took the time to do this, go back and actually read the Jewish law. If they've suffered trauma with bleeding, exposed bleeding, they were not washed. They were buried on time, but they didn't wash. So that it doesn't make sense that he was washed and then they put the shroud on him. We should talk about the sedarium since you brought it up. The burial cloths were lying there when, as John said, and then off to the side was, some people call it the napkin, but it's the face cloth. And when he was on the cross, the Jews were very sensitive about losing blood. All the blood is supposed to be buried with the person. So the face cloth was put on him most likely when he was on the cross. That sedarium is in Oviedo, Spain. And we know that that sedarium has been in Oviedo, I think somewhere around the 700s, 800s, which is long before the carbon dating. And if you put the two side by side, the shroud and the sedarium, there are at least, I think, 120 points of congruence. The blood stains match, and all these things match. I actually started my own little collection of replicas. So I've got a replica of the full shroud, and I just sent away for a replica of the sedarium. So I'm going to go ahead and place my sedarium over the facial area where most of the blood was coming out. Another very interesting thing too that the Sturck team did is they fluoresced. They use UV fluorescence, and if you fluoresce it, you can tell if heat was applied in the image area. Like you, some people will say, oh, they just made a metal statue, something called the bas relief, a partial metal statue, heated it up, and then pressed the cloth down on it, and that would cause this aging, premature aging of the linen. But it's shown that there is no heat applied to the image area whatsoever. But what it does show the fluorescence is blood will separate into the blood cells, into the serum. You can actually see with fluorescence where there's the blood, and then you could see a halo of serum around the blood stains. How could that ever be forged? We definitely have a 2,000-year-old cloth there. Even go so far as, what's the size of it? I've told you it was about 14.5 feet by 3.5 feet. Well,
hold that thought about about the size, only because we're coming up onto another break, and I don't want to have you inside. Okay, let's take this break right now.
Good.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
If you have a podcast and want to monetize it stress-free, you need the Odyssey Creator Lab. We'll host your podcast for free, and our experienced sales team brings in the advertisers and the revenue. Easy. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com and let us show you the money.
Welcome back to the final segment of Amplify with our guest, Dr. John Sottosanti. We're talking about the Shroud of Turin, and I cut you short before we went to the break, if you want to pick up from there.
Sure. Again, the shroud is roughly 14.5 by 3.5 feet. But if you take the exact measurement and convert it into the measurement of the day 2,000 years ago, they measured a cloth that large in what was known as Assyrian cubits. And that was the measurement that they used for trade. And Jerusalem was not on the main trade route, but it was very close to the main trade route from the east that went to the west. And it's very likely that Joseph of Arimathea bought that cloth. And some people actually say it's a perfect size for a tablecloth. Maybe it was used as a tablecloth. They would have to have cleaned it because there probably wouldn't food and wine all over it. So I doubt that, but it was definitely fit in perfectly. At 2 cubits by 8 cubits is the size of the Shroud of Turin.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to leave. I've gone to another topic. Go ahead. Okay. Well, another thing is if you look at the image of the cloth, particularly the photo negative, it's the entire body. So you see the crucifixion wounds and the feet, and I would normally say the hands, because that's what's depicted in most of our churches. But we know that if you put a nail, say, through the palm of the hand and hung somebody on it, it would tear out through the fingers very quickly because the could not hold the weight of the body. The only area around there that could hold the weight of the body is in the wrist. So for sure, the nail may have entered into the heel of the palm area, but it went through the bones of the wrist down in there. So Jesus's hands on the shroud image are crossed in the groin area, and the wrist that you can see has a major amount of blood on it. And that would be from the crucifixion. Now, his hands, both of them, you can see quite clearly, each of them have only 4 fingers showing. Well, we noted today that the median nerve, which wasn't discovered to maybe 1600s, 1700s, median nerve controls much of the movement of the thumb, one of the many nerves involved, and it was most likely cut, which would have caused retraction of the thumb, along with the ligaments being cut as well. So some people think that that's why you see four fingers. Now, how would a forger know to go ahead and do that?
Yes.
So I think another thing to start with is what actually happened to those cloths after they found the empty tomb. We don't know. In fact, you had a very nice reading, I think, earlier about Mary Magdalene, that she, and correct me, Father Ron, if I'm wrong, particularly when it comes to scripture, but she arrived at the tomb and they were going to finish anointing the body, and it was like, he's gone. They stolen our Lord.
Yeah, but that wasn't that's not scripture, just so I tell you. That's a story of faith and imagination. It's a friend of mine who reads scripture and then feels inspired to reflect on it.
Well, it was very inspired.
Okay, go ahead.
So she went ahead and told John and Peter, and they come running, you know, and John arrived first, but Peter went in first. So if we don't know what happened, it makes sense that maybe the cloth was given to Mary for a while, but we have no idea. But it disappeared. But it had to disappear because the Romans were in charge, and the Romans would have wanted to destroy any evidence at all that Christ even existed. So mm-hmm. It disappeared. Now, there are legends. And one of the first ones had to do with the king of Edessa. Edessa was in southeast Turkey. And there were several different King Abgars. So we'll just say one of the King Abgars was healed by a cloth with the face of Christ on it. And we think it may be the shroud folded up so just the face was exposed. And that was brought to Edessa. And Edessa became Christian very early. So that very likely could happen. And then somewhere around the year 590, I may be wrong, but I think the writer that we have evidence of and documentation of was something like Evagrius Scholasticus. Mm-hmm. And he wrote about Edessa in the year 540. And the Persians surrounded the city and were about ready to take over the city when somebody pulled out a cloth with the face of Christ on it. And we again think it's the Shroud of Turin folded up, so just the face is showing. And that was paraded around the city and venerated, praying for relief from the Persian invasion, and that's what happened. The Persians were not able to take over the city.
Go ahead.
We know about it in the year 600. Now, another thing happened around that. There's an image called the Pantocrator image. If I were to show it to you right now, you would recognize it right away. But it's Christ with long hair, a beard, and his fingers held up, two fingers in the sign of peace. Mm. And the image is famous for a lot of reasons. One is one hand is holding the Bible or the Old Testament, and that's the side of Christ, preaching the law. And the other one is more softer. For soft, it's compassion, and the eyes are changed, etc. But that image of Christ, from then on, every image of Christ looks something like that. Well, the Pantocrator image looks very much like the image on the Shroud of Turin. In fact, Dr. Wenger and his wife did a study comparing the Pantocrator image with the image on the cloth of Edessa, which also is called the medallion. And they're very, very similar. So in the early days, if you looked at a picture of Christ, say in the first three centuries, Christ usually looked like a young Roman, very little no facial hair at all. And it wasn't until somewhere around the year 600 that Christ looked like he did on the Shroud and on the Panther Crater, and he's looked like that ever since. So it was in Odessa for quite a while, and then eventually we have evidence of it being in Constantinople. I think the day it arrived in Constantinople, there exists a sermon that was given by the local bishop. And we have evidence that it was in Constantinople to the day that the city was sacked, I believe in the year 1204. And we have a written testimony by a knight who said that in a certain church on Fridays, they had this device that would raise a cloth up out of a box, and he would see the entire body of Christ. So we're quite certain that that was in Constantinople in the year 1204. Then between 1204 and 1355, it's relatively unknown where the Shroud was. It was probably hidden for a variety of reasons.
Is it a challenge for each of us in some way?
Yeah, each of us have to say, who do I think the man on the Shroud is? I mean, who is he, and what does he mean to us? Now, there's a chapter in the book, Father Rod. Do you remember the chapter where my patient, Francis Crick?
Oh, yes, yes.
Okay. I don't know how many of our listeners will recognize that name, but Time Magazine listed him at one of the top 100 people of the 20th century.
Right.
Francis Crick discovered DNA, the DNA molecule, the double helix. He was a patient of mine because he moved from Cambridge to La Jolla, where we have a Salk Institute. And so he came to San Diego right around when I was setting up my practice. He became my patient for 20 years. Devout atheist. So when I had a debate with him one day about whether God really existed, he was sure God didn't exist. And he was adamant about it. So I brought up the Shroud of Turin, and he immediately said, oh, yeah, well, the carbon dating proved that wrong. Of course, he didn't know anything else about all those other facts. Neither did I. So I probably didn't have a real strong argument back then. But there's so many interesting things. There isn't even an item called it's a Hungarian Prey Codex. And Prey is the name of the man who found it. And the codex is a book. And in the book is a drawing, a depiction of Christ laid out on a cloth and at the burial. And then there's another image where he's resurrected. But when you look at the cloth, it actually was drawn as a herringbone weave. And there are four holes in the Prey Codex that have now been named the poker holes, because on the Shroud of Turin, sometime in maybe, we don't know, but it could have been the year 800, 900, it was being used as an altar cloth. Somebody had a chirubble with coal in it and was spreading the incense, and some of the coal probably dropped out onto the cloth. So there are little coal markings on the cloth, if you can picture that. Well, the angle of the coal markings, those four holes, is perfectly matched in the Prey Codex that was 200 or 300 years older than what the carbon dating says. So, yeah, we each of us have to say, what does that cloth mean to us?
Right. It could have been incense. I mean, that's we incense. Even today, and sometimes it comes near to starting fires in some indication. In some situations, doesn't happen that often. I'd be interested if there's more you have to say about the importance of the teeth. I know that you wrote that you raised the question: does the fact that some of the teeth are still present defy explanation?
Well, my feeling is, it's not just the teeth. Other people have reported that they can see the bones in the hand. So, but basically area of the skull and the bones of the hand. If you look at the image of the photo negative image, you will notice the figures are unusually long. And some of the shroud experts say it's because in reality, you're seeing also the bones of the hand. So that's quite interesting. So, you know, having a photograph of the resurrection, if you stop and think about it, yes, how unbelievable that is. Some people who are on the lecture tour have used the term that Christ took the first selfie.
Yeah.
Yeah, he left evidence of that. And if indeed the teeth are on the image, and if indeed the bones are on the image, it was a burst of some type of radiation. It wasn't regular radiation, and in the paper I write that the upper was different than the lower. The lips are closed, according to most scientists and experts that have studied the image. So if you can see the teeth, you right. are looking through the lips. You're seeing, in a sense, and so picture this. The shroud itself becomes the X-ray film, even though there's no silver nitrate on it, which for top photography, that's what it would be. But this burst of radiation captures the image out on the cloth. So the image is going from within the body out and captures some of the bones, some of the teeth, and projects it out on the cloth. So for the skeptics in the world, they're going to fight that as much as they can. And I am so busy for a variety of reasons right now. I got word that one of the best known skeptics of the Shroud of Turin wants to at least have a written debate, if not a verbal debate, with me on whether or not they're the teeth of the Shroud of Turin. This person has no education in facial anatomy, no formal education, mm-hmm. where I have 8 years of it, counting the specialty training.
Is there more for us to discover yet? Is there more to be revealed, do you think?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I mean, to have that happen, the Vatican has to let a team of scientists go in there, and we're not sure that's going to happen. And we have no idea when it's going to happen. But there's a very active Shroud group that's pushing for it. I think there's a chance Pope Leo might. But that's just conjecture. It's a guess. It's no way. Do I have any evidence? But for anybody that's interested in the Shroud, I suggest that you probably start with shroud.com and go ahead and go on Amazon and look up some of the Shroud books. My book talks about the Shroud, but it's part of my conversion story. In three chapters, I talk about the Shroud. But, it's my conversion story, Mortal Adhesions. I really wrote the book, again, because of we're mortal individuals, and we don't understand that we're really eternal individuals. And what we need to do is get rid of all the bad stuff that's attached to us that we do, that are sins, and get rid of them before we die. And as you said, Father Ron, we don't know when that's going to take place.
Right, much like Crick. No, go ahead, please.
No. I'm trying to remember the name of the scientist that came up with the theory that it's called a bet. You ought to make a bet with yourself that if you make a bet that all this is true, Christ lived and resurrected and everything he said was true, and that if you go do everything right, you're going to heaven. If you do everything wrong, you're going to hell. You ought to make the bet that it's true. You ought to change your life, do what Christ said, and become a follower of Christ and a different person. Because if it's true, you will have lived a good life, and then you'll see the face of Christ, and you'll live in heaven forever after. Now, if it's all false, and you live this good life and die, but there's no life afterwards, you still have lived a good life and had plenty of friends because you were such a good person, and you've lost nothing. But if there really is a God and you lived a bad life and you go to hell, it's forever. You know, we just had the reading in church recently about Lazarus on one side of the canyon.
Yes.
And the man, the rich man on the other side, and his lips are parched. And he's saying, would you bring Lazarus to Moses? Would you bring Lazarus over to here and have him wet my lips?
Right.
But there's no crossing over, right?
No crossing over, right.
Right.
So, how can it give us hope?
Well, you know, it gives us hope because, we believers believe in the Gospels and what the Gospels teach us. And what the Shroud of Turin really is, it's a visual expression of the Gospels, of certainly of Christ's passion, his death, and his resurrection. And so with that hope, everything that Christ said, and certainly Paul with so many of his writings, tells us how to live our life. We have to hope. My mother in the book, remember I talked about my mother?
Yeah, she talked about your mother, right, yes.
She saw heaven. She didn't have the typical near-death experience, but she had a near-death experience. And when she awoke from it, she looked me right in the face and said, John, I saw heaven. And then she described it in a way. My mom was into colors of flowers. She loved flowers. And she saw heaven filled with beautiful colors and flowers. It was quite the experience. So anybody that's interested, read Mortal Adhesions.
Yes. Do you hope to still study it even further from your professional perspective?
Oh, I will. Yeah, I'm already joining all the Shroud groups and the scientific Shroud groups. So I think I'm coming from the area of surgery, particularly oral surgery, I think I can add something to the group, and I plan on doing that. Again, if you have some interest in what I've done, put Sotosanti, Sotosanti, Sotosanti Shroud. Google it, and you'll come up with lots of information of what I've been doing about the Shroud.
And there's no question but that with the advance of technology, there's going to be there'll be more to discover, I would think. But in the end, our faith doesn't really rest on its authenticity when it comes down to it. Our faith is certainly based on Christ's teaching and all that flowed from it. Would you agree?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's you've got to have faith. And it took me a long time to have faith, but I definitely am truly a believer. And it wasn't just the Shroud, but the Shroud was a big part of it.
Our guest this evening has been Dr. John Sotosanti, using his book Mortal Adhesions to talk about the Shroud of Turin. Thank you so very much for being here tonight. Your knowledge is incredible, and you're so, so very inspiring.
Thank you so much.
Blessings.
Really appreciate it.
Blessing on all your efforts.
Thank you. God bless.
God bless, too.
Bye now.
Just time to say, don't forget how precious life is, and we can come across that in many different ways as we reflect even on this program in terms of how God is presenting ways for us that we might understand his teachings more fully, want to learn more about it, and how precious life is and how precious life is, love is. Love can work miracles in so many ways. So life is precious, love is powerful, but it's not used just to love ourselves, but it's to love one another. So tell someone that you love him or her, and certainly the world that we live in today, we need to pray for peace. We need to pray for peace as we hear so many things in the background that don't come forward. but come back next Sunday and amplify with us.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $150 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$150 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
If you have a podcast and want to monetize it stress-free, you need the Odyssey Creator Lab. We'll host your podcast for free, and our experienced sales team brings in the advertisers and the revenue. Easy. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com and let us show you the money.